Hey, this is Nicole DeBoer, aka Esri Dax, and you're listening to the Shuttle Pod.
All right, we are back, friends. Thank you for joining us again for the 45th installment of the Shuttle Pod. My name is Jared Whitley. I'm delighted to be able to do this with you guys every other week. And I'm excited to do this with my good friends who join me on this weekly excursion into the final frontier. Mainly, we are here with Kayla Iacovino.
Hey, everyone.
Matt Wright.
Hey, guys.
And the inimitable Ryan Drew.
Wow.
Mr. Drew.
Jesus. Hi, everybody. Good to be back.
Okay, and we have a fun topic today. I think, Matt, you have been the driver in wanting to do this again, but we are doing Best of the Weird Volume 2. Remember about a year ago, we did an installment on episodes we thought were kind of weird in the franchise, and we wanted to return back to that. Matt, why is it so fun to talk about weird episodes?
I think just because, you know, sometimes they're overlooked, and so it's kind of fun to sort of turn the magnifying glass on something that maybe was overlooked but actually is kind of a gem, or at least has something unique that people just kind of go, I don't know, that episode's weird, and they skip it in their rewatch or whatever. So I think it's fun.
So I remember last time we talked about Masks, and
yes,
we talked about Move Along Home.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to remember what the third one was we talked about.
I believe it was The Lights of Zatar.
Lights of Zatar.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so we had a TNG episode, a DS9 episode, and a TOS episode. Because we always try to cover as much of the franchise as we can, even the installments, which maybe aren't as beloved as some of the other ones. And this week, we're doing the same. We have two TNG episodes, a Voyager episode, and an animated series episode. So, Kayla, you wanted to talk about Sub Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk about The Thaw. Brian, you quote Magics of Magus 2 more than anyone else I've ever met whenever you say, Brian Kirk. I love it every time.
It's just to highlight the absurdity of it. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. Absurd. Okay, and then Matt, you're going to finish this out. We're going to talk about the TNG episode Home Soil.
Yes.
And we've all had a chance to re-watch these in the last week, so we're all excited to get into this. So unless there's anything else, let's just start it up.
Okay.
Okay, Kayla, tell us about what happens in Sub Rosa for those who may not have memory off in front of them.
All right. Well, just before we dive into it, I just wanted to remind everyone that in our Best of the Weird installments, we're not necessarily highlighting bad episodes, right? So, like, Sub Rosa is one of those that's sort of notorious for being one of the stinkers of the entire series, Next Generation. And like last time we talked about Masks and Move Along Home, and those are often considered episodes that people dislike. But we're not diving into, you know, what we think about these episodes in terms of whether they were, you know, good or bad. It's more about how they're unique, like Matt said, or why they're just strange, and that's a bit off-putting to some people. But it's highly entertaining for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is not a beloved one. In fact, what we've done is we've checked out the IMDb scores for all this. And Kayla, what is the IMDb score for Sub Rosa?
So Sub Rosa has, I believe, the worst IMDb ranking of all Next Generation episodes, if I'm correct there, at a 5.0.
Actually, that's the worst.
Oh,
really?
You know what? No, I'm wrong. It's the second worst. The worst is Shades of Grey. By far,
sure,
which
show.
Gets a 3.8.
Wow.
And then Sub Rosa comes in at number 2 to 5.0, and then everything is above 5. Everything else.
And, wow. And so then the best average for IMDb on this, right, was an 8.6 was a typical.
8.6 is the series average, yeah.
For overall, the series
for
average.
For Next Generation. So
for some context, this is a 5.0 out of a series that's otherwise an 8.6 overall. So there you go. Yikes.
Yeah, but if we were going to do a bell curve, we'd have to start at 3.8, right?
Yeah, I think so. That's true.
Although it's pretty clearly an outlier, because it's, you know, 3.8 is
good point.
The lowest one, and then the second is all the way up to 5.0, which is quite a lot better.
So, and it's a clip show, so in a way, we can really just kind of toss it
you
aside.
You can just
kind of
count it
right?
out.
It's, just
yeah.
whatever.
Just,
like,
yeah, it's unfortunate that episode was made.
Yeah.
Writer's strike, everybody. Yep.
Yep, that's what that was.
Yep. All right.
All right. Well, I'm ready to dive into Sub Rosa, if you
let's
guys
do a deep dive.
Let's light the candle, Kayla.
Let's light this candle, you guys. Just to get everyone's memory jogged, I'm going to read to you the Memory Alpha description of this episode, which states, Beverly Crusher attends her grandmother's funeral, but a mysterious entity that inhabited her grandmother is now focusing on her.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. And that's an accurate description.
It is.
I don't know that I would agree with the word inhabited.
No, right? I don't like that. I would say haunted, frankly.
Haunted, yeah. Haunted slash raped?
Yeah, you know what's funny? The inhabited isn't exactly wrong. I was just thinking about that same debate in my head as we were
he
talking about
the description. He was inside her. I'm sorry.
He was inside
especially
her.
After and she remember, was dead. Like, he possesses her body like a zombie.
That's true.
Right?
Totally.
Is...
And remember, he actually does inhabit them because there's a sign. Do you guys remember the sign is they have green eyes when he's inhabiting them.
Oh, that's right.
So he actually does sort of become a symbiotic, weird, you know, thing with them. At least
like a parasite.
Sometimes. Yeah, so at least sometimes.
Well, not quite a parasite, though. It's almost like a symbiosis.
Symbiotic. Right, it's a symbiotic thing.
Sure.
Because the impression is the impression we're given is that there's a certain mutual benefit going on.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's true. And, and based on what...
goofy.
Yeah. It's still creepy, though. It's still very creepy.
So taking all that into consideration, why is this episode considered weird, Kayla? I mean, lay it all out there.
I think I will lay it on because this episode lays it on thick. I think this episode is considered weird because it's sort of cringeworthy to watch basically what Gase McFadden has to do in this episode, which is like orgasm on screen. It's, you know, so this mysterious entity, for those of you that still don't remember this episode, is this guy who said to me in his mid-30s but looks more like 48.
He's got old timey clothes on, that's why. Yeah,
there's no way this guy's in his mid-30s. Anyway, I digress. He is this ghost creature thing that's made up of some kind of energy that has been possessing women in Beverly's family for generations. But this symbiotic relationship that Brian alluded to is that he basically gives them sexual pleasure and makes them, like, you know, I don't know how else to say it, makes them really horny for him. And that's what he's giving to them is this sexual pleasure and this drive to love him.
Right.
And what he gets is this host body to live in because he needs a host in order to stay alive, basically. And he can kind of transfer when the grandmother dies, he transfers into this candle. And then this maybe my favorite character in the episode, what's his name? Quint.
Yep.
Quint Groundskeeper Willie. I think that's his name is Groundskeeper Willie.
Groundskeeper Willie.
Groundskeeper Quint. Yeah. Which is this guy with this very thick Scottish accent just like busts into her house, Beverly's grandmother's house, and like tries to steal her candle and then just keeps yelling at her, "Did I light that candle?"
Yes, yes.
And it's like, look, dude, maybe if you didn't just like come in like a madman and start screaming about didn't I light the candle, like just be like, hey, you know what? You're going to find this hard to believe, but like there's some weird stuff going on. There's like an alien entity. Like maybe people would listen to you, right? Like,
Or maybe all this futuristic technology we have, maybe you could use it to scan this one object here because we're concerned that there might be something wrong with it.
No, but instead he needs to be a raving lunatic. But that's going to work, right?
And later in the episode, he like goes. Is he on the Enterprise?
He goes to the substation.
Oh, it's
for,
the
like,
substation
the weather
on the planet.
Grid.
Oh, yeah, and he and he's like sabotages tampering with some kind of, I don't know if it's the power energy conduit or something, but he's tampering with stuff in the panel. And Data's like, I'm gonna have to ask you to stop that. And he's like, no, I can't. I've got to do this thing. And he's all crazy. It's like again, maybe not the best approach.
The weirdest thing about all of that is he busts into her house, you know, warns her in a crazy, you know, raving way. And then one of the things that's something really is really odd is the next day, Beverly apologizes to him for not listening to him. And I'm like, wait, no, this is the wrong, you should not be apologizing to him. He should be apologizing to you, like, for busting into your house.
Right? Well,
it's
to
so
be
backwards.
Fair,
anyway.
To be fair, she had said, oh, I read my grandmother's journal and I realized how much you meant to her. So yeah. I think she wanted to be nice to him because of
it's
that.
It's still weird. It's like a weird apologetic thing. It's like, all right, whatever.
Yeah. Also, okay, here's another... It's the whole sexual thing that makes this a weird episode, right? And
yes,
yeah.
Definitely.
And it's not only the sexual scenes with Beverly orgasming on screen. It's also this idea that she comes about this by reading her grandmother's erotic journal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's so
weird. That's
weird.
Yeah. Like, I wrote down a quote that I liked... particularly liked, which is Beverly talking to Deanna, who says, quote, "I did fall asleep reading a particularly erotic passage in my grandmother's journal." Mm-hmm. Like, what?
Mm-hmm. Who says that, right? Like, when does that ever happen?
That's like, you should realize there's something weird. And here's an interesting thought is that Deanna in this episode is seeing her friend acting very strangely, reading her grandma's porn, and falling in love with this guy and like quitting Starfleet and all this stuff. It's like, this is the one time Deanna should have like been in someone else's business.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And so she's like high-fiving her for getting laid or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, wait, what? What?
It's also, and the thing that struck me, besides the weirdness, contrasting this with Home Soil, which is a first season episode, this is a 7th season episode, mm-hmm. is Deanna is like reading people's minds when they're in a different room in Home Soil, right?
That's she true,
is,
yeah.
She's wonderfully empathic in that episode. And here, it's like she should be able to tell that something's a little off with her friend, right? Well, there's even a scene where she excuses herself, whatever, and I wanted to hear Beverly say, "Oh, no, I want you to stay. I don't want to be alone." And Deanna should have said, "No, you do," right? Just a little reminder to the audience that she perceives things that the rest of us couldn't. And there's none of that there at all. And if there was, again, ever a time for her to be in someone's business using her extrasensory perception, this is the time.
Right.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. She should also be totally aware of Ronan, who's like somewhat present and somewhat like inhabiting her.
Yeah. I mean if you encounter four points,
she sense a duality.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There you go. There's a Troy line and was not used. It should have been used, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think what happened is that they had, you know how they had done Attached and you know, they had this Beverly Picard will they won't they thing. So they gave that concern all to Picard where he shows up and is like, "What are you doing? You can't resign." You know, they made it they were trying to make a really kind of ridiculous soap opera triangle, right? That Picard would tell her like, "Don't go." Ronan's telling her, "Oh no, you need to go down to the planet and stay with me," right? And they tried to make it kind of goofy and soap opera, is I think what happened there.
Well, the whole thing is kind of a soap opera. It's like staged like a Harlequin novel.
It totally is. Yeah. Totally.
It even looks like one. Like the
yes. Yeah.
The guy with the mane of long flowing locks, the big mane of hair.
Yeah, the Fabio. You know,
the lighting of the sets is very kind of tacky.
Conveniently, it's on a terraform planet that wants to be, like, I don't know, Scotland in the 1800s.
Scotland.
Yeah, it's like supposed to be Jane Eyre or something.
Yeah, very Jane Eyre looking,
I mean, that guy, when you first see him, I was like, holy shit, is that Fabio?
Yeah, pretty much.
You consider him an actor / model and not the other way around.
I would also like to point out that this episode was directed by Jonathan Frakes.
Yeah, it was.
And I believe it was the last episode that he directed of The Next Generation. Not too shockingly, this was one of the last episodes of the series.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I just, seeing his name at the beginning and then watching, knowing what I was in for and watching these scenes with Beverly orgasming while wrapped in her grandmother's shawl and just imagining Jonathan Frakes behind the camera. Like, telling her motivation for this scene. That's like, that made it doubly awkward.
I know.
Yeah.
And you know what, though?
More, Gates, more!
Like, I've got to give a shout-out to Gates McFadden on this one, because she was giving it her all.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Oh, she was rocking it, for sure.
No pun intended.
No pun intended.
She was burning the candle at both ends.
Oh, there you go. That is one of the things I have to say I really like about this episode. It's just the fact that it's part of season 7, and TNG is such a well-oiled machine that even kind of a crappy story and a weird story is just executed well and like feels like they're really on the ball for it. Because at this point, they have been. They know what they know what The Next Generation is about. There's a style for shooting Next Gen.
Mm-hmm.
There's a style, just the production style. There's everything. It's all well-established at this point. and they really were at the peak of their game at this point. So there's just something nice about it, even if it's not the best episode, you know?
Yeah, but it's kind of symptomatic of how uneven the seventh year was.
Yes. Very uneven.
That too.
Some of the best some of the worst episodes.
Yeah. The seventh year is littered with a lot of crap. Yeah. With this being the worst, probably the worst part of it. But this
is not exactly the Pegasus or All Good Things that we're watching.
No, not at all.
So Kayla, if a casual fan was talking to you at a convention and mentioned, and it'd been one of those sessions where they rank the worst episodes and this one came out, what would you tell them? Would you try to convince them to watch this, or would you say, no, you don't need to watch this?
You know, I'm not sure. If someone was going to go through and watch like all of Star Trek, I wouldn't tell them to skip it. But I don't know if I would choose this. Because I think part of what makes it awkward, and well, I was wondering this to myself, and correct me if you guys disagree with this, because I'm not sure if I agree with it or not either. But as I was watching it last night, I was thinking, maybe part of what makes this so awkward is because I know the characters so well.
Mm.
And so, you know, maybe if this had been a story told with people I didn't know, you know, because like I know Beverly and I know her relationships with people like Deanna and Picard and like, you know, so I think that made it more awkward for me. So I wonder if a casual fan who had never seen Trek before, had only seen a couple of episodes, I wonder if they would react as strongly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's okay. A good point. I see what you mean, because they wouldn't feel the same weird sense of the characters being off.
Right. They're just like, oh, I guess this woman just, you know.
Yeah. So for example, what if this was in season 3 or something, much earlier? Can't be 2 because she wasn't there. Because
she wasn't there.
But let's say this is maybe not season 1, although season 1 has a lot of weird episodes too. But let's say this was like a season 3 episode. I could almost buy it. You know what I mean? I think I see your point there. Yeah. It's still not great, but I could almost, you know, buy it.
I don't buy Beverly acting as irrationally as she does in this episode at any point in the series. Maybe in the first season when you didn't know her well enough, but certainly not by the third.
Well, she, you know, I guess she's acting under the influence of this alien, so that's
right.
She's not supposed to be acting necessarily in character.
No.
But still.
It's very clear. It's very clear she's being influenced.
It's still kind of insulting that these people are like professionals and should know better. They're explorers. She's a doctor. She should know she's being compromised.
Deanna should have picked up on it, too.
Deanna should. Yeah, absolutely.
This is a crew that is accustomed to mind control.
Yeah, exactly. They're all used to it at this point.
So here's something I wanted to ask you guys. What do you think, what would you say this episode is about? And I don't mean it's about a ghost raping Beverly. Like, is it, because I was reading some fan reactions to this episode online, and there's some people who are like riding the Sub Rosa subway, like they are.
Yeah, some people love it.
They are 100% on board, and some people just despise it.
Well, I think it's funny too, because you know when Jerry Taylor, who adapted it, and Braga, who kind of wrote the final treatment on it, they didn't intend. You know, if you ask them, like they certainly didn't intend for it to be a creepy, kind of almost rapey episode. They really thought they were doing something kind of amusing and like a like Jared said, like a throwback to kind of a period piece almost. And they just thought it would be like fun and neat with a little sci-fi twist. And that's not how it turned out, I don't think. But there are people who seem to see that in it, you know.
Yeah, really, and there are, and according to some of the stuff I've read about the episode while it was in production, there were a lot of like women coming to the set, patting Braga on the back, saying "Did good job doing this" kind of thing.
Oh wow, really?
So yeah, I get it, like Kayla said, weird. It's got its fans, and you know, it's just you know,
yeah.
And they must have liked the guy playing Ronan because they brought him back to be Kira's love interest on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, who I didn't like him there either, actually. But yeah, I didn't. Shakar is basically there to be an obstacle for Kira and Odo, I think, really. And then there you go. But anyway, that's a different topic.
Yeah, I think the thing is they want it. Several times throughout the franchise, we've seen them try to do like genre-specific episodes. Like Fistful of Data, they're doing a Western. Here, they're doing like a gothic horror type of thing. And I think because there's so much trying to follow those genre conventions, they're not really thinking about anything else except approximating that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure.
But I guess, like, what's the moral of the story?
I don't know if this is the one.
I don't think there is one. I don't think there's any theme.
Honestly,
don't
I think
light
that's
mysterious candles.
I think that's the greatest failure of this episode. And I was reading one a fan's reaction to this episode, saying that it was about addiction.
Oh yeah.
I mean, sort of.
I could see it as a stretch, but I did not get that at all. When they're, you know, the
not
idea that Beverly is addicted to this man and would do anything.
They kind of go that direction for a while. She gets pretty crazed
at a certain point, she does become obsessive.
Yeah,
but I wouldn't equate obsession with addiction at all.
Yeah, there's also scene where Beverly like expresses that like worry or concern, or that she's going to die alone or sense of isolation, or
sure
that might feed into that. Yeah. So
good
there's
point.
Nothing that
right.
sets that up.
Right.
In my opinion.
Good point.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, I'm not really sure what this episode is about. And that's another thing that makes it weird. Is like, what were we supposed to get out of this?
Right. Exactly. Good.
Hmm. And the grandma, I'm sorry, but I just burst into laughter every time I see the grandma waking up out of the coffin.
Oh, yeah. Pop up out of the coffin.
You're not Nana.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, not one of TNG's finest hours.
No.
But a very entertaining one.
I will say that's right. It's entertaining. Yeah. It's weird and entertaining for its own on its own merits. So there you go.
My one thing is the alien governor, which was weird that he was an alien. He kind of looks like a Tellarite, but he isn't, and I wish he was.
Mm.
That would have been a nice.
Yeah, that would have been fun.
Oh yeah.
Touch. Yeah.
Yes. Instead, he's just like generic guy number 300. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. That is a bummer that they missed opportunity.
Well, the last thing that I'll say about this episode is that I foresee a very fantastic couple cosplay idea in my future. A.K.A. Yeah. Beverly with the grandmother shawl and candle and journal and Ronan.
Yeah. Yeah. And you also need like a fainting couch for him to approach you on.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna see if I can't make this happen for Star Trek Las Vegas this year. I just need to figure out what to use to make the candle. I need some kind of tin can or something that I cut holes in and put a handle on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure.
And you have to get a wig for Andy.
Yeah, exactly. Or you can just, you know, grow his hair out. It'll be fine.
I'll dress up as an old lady and get some green contact lenses.
Yes.
Jared, you can just pop up randomly, freak everyone out.
Just lay on the ground and like pop up.
That's not Nana.
Go, that's not Nana.
Oh man, you have that would be so fucking weird and so great.
Okay.
People would be avoiding us at all costs.
Oh yeah, they'd be like, "The hell's wrong with those guys?"
New goal: to be the weirdest group of people at the Star Trek convention.
Yeah, which would be a hell of a stretch.
That's an achievement. Let's just say.
Yeah.
So, should we move on to episode number 2?
I think I'm warming up to doing episode number 2.
All right. Well, let's. Why don't we let this one thaw out a bit, huh, Jared?
Let's do it, Kayla.
Boom, boom.
All right. So the second episode is Jared is your pick. And it is the Voyager episode, The Thaw. Why don't you remind everyone what happened in that episode?
Okay, so the crew attempts to rescue 3 aliens they find in stasis on a planet they're passing. And they discover that there's a bizarre computer program that's kind of been created from their subconscious. And he's sort of this terrifying fear clown. And he traps B'Elanna and Harry. And eventually he lets B'Elanna out to go warn the rest of the Voyager crew, don't try to do anything. These people are here. They're mine. They're in my domain. And then it's sort of a battle of wits with Captain Janeway versus the clown to try to rescue not just Harry and then the 3 aliens as well. So that's and there's a lot of craziness that goes in with this. And this is a very weird episode because there aren't a lot of crazy clowns in Starfleet. There are a lot of them in fiction in general, to the point that it's kind of a cliche. But I think this is the only one in Star Trek. And there's a lot of weird stuff going on, like Harry almost gets decapitated with the guillotine, and there's like all these, you know, the clown, the fear clown has this weird entourage of like circus performers who kind of remind me of rejects from that TNG episode, The Cost of Living, with Lwaxana and Alexander Troy, on the holodeck. Yeah. There's a guy who says the higher, the fewer. Yeah. And something that's really cool to kind of tie into that episode is they brought Carol Stricken back to play one of the entourage. Yep.
That's
and
right.
He's the actor who, of course, played Mr. Hom, and then he played Lurch in the Addams Family movies back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. He was a giant in Twin Peaks.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure he was. Yeah, very tall guy. They put him in a costume so you don't see his face, but the opposite of Mr. Hom, we get to hear his voice, which is kind of cool. Nice little bit of continuity there. It's a weird episode, but I think it works really, really well. I'm not a huge Voyager fan, but this is an episode that I genuinely enjoy.
Me too.
So we should point out that this has an IMDb ranking of 7.3, and that Voyager as a whole has a ranking of 7.7. So this is actually considered a very good episode.
Yeah, and there's this online reviewer I really like. It's called SF Debris. I think I quoted him in an article for Trek maybe a couple years ago. And he gives it a 9 out of 10, and he calls it the best episode of the first two seasons of Voyager.
Wow.
And I think I'd agree with
him.
That's
high praise.
Yeah. Yeah, the other thing I really appreciate about this episode is that it was in season 2, because if this had been in season 5 or later, this would have been a Borg episode. The idea of finding three aliens whose minds are all linked. Yeah, this would have. In fact, they did that one where they find a couple people who are linked to still in the collective, and it's driving them crazy. So I'm glad this episode happened when it did. Anyway, I think it's weird, but it's good.
I agree. And it's so Manowski. Manowski wrote this episode.
Yes. It has all the weird hallmarks.
Yeah, it's very high concept. It's just very odd. It goes into dark places.
But they set up like the rules really well, so we know what the conflict is, and we know so the crew has an idea of, okay, here's what we need to do to more than just technobabble our way out of this. We have to actually outwit this guy. And there's even this great like stupid Neelix moment where he says like, "I think the way to get rid of fear is a funny joke or something," and everyone just looks at him across the conference table like, "We're trying to solve a problem here, and you're contributing nothing."
I felt kind of bad for him. I was like, that's not that bad of an idea.
but he's an evil clown. He already knows all the jokes.
Yeah, I did find it interesting, though, that this computer somehow picked up on everybody's fear.
Yeah, that was the interesting part.
Yeah, like that was kind of a random thing the machine did.
Well, I guess they all have this anxiety of being stuck there forever, right? Because they were there.
Sure, I guess so. Yeah. I guess that's what motivates it.
Here's
a
question I have. Are they just trapped for eternity in this one room?
I think so.
Why?
Yeah, they seem to. They seem to have let the clown like run the show. Like the clown is their embodiment of like all their fears, right?
And he took over everything. Yeah.
He controls it now. Yeah. Right. So that's his preferred environment.
He is a computer.
Yeah, exactly.
Just seems like if you're going to go through all the trouble to build this machine and build this virtual environment, it's going to be more than just like one room with...
Well, it is, but the whole point is that, you know, the trap is they didn't foresee that the clown would sort of surface and take control.
It's been corrupted.
I guess yeah. Right.
It's, you know, unforeseen consequences, basically.
Also, we have to acknowledge the limitations of a network television show with a limited budget, right? I mean, the clown could have done a lot scarier things if they'd had $10 million.
Yep. So why do you think they chose the clown and the circus performers to be the representation of fear?
Well, they're freaky anyway, honestly. They're freaky things. A lot of people don't like clowns. I don't like clowns particularly, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
And... you know, it's just they're freaky little things that I think we've all come to identify as, you know, bizarre or unusual, you know, images.
And they all look alien while also being kind of terrestrial, like the whole idea of this circus entourage, which is bizarre and kind of old-timey. Even in the 90s, I mean, the idea of the circus coming to town is something from the 19th century. But it's also easy to make it alien, so I think it works better than if they'd made them, you know, like Viking monsters trying to beat them up or something like that. I don't know. Or
that's a different Voyager episode. Or
yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's why that came to mind, is the Beowulf episode. I also have to say, I think what really makes this episode work, because it could have easily not worked, is Mike McKean as the clown.
He's so good.
He's good.
He's what Holy makes cow. This episode.
Yeah, because he does like this bizarre mixture of trying to be funny and trying to be terrifying and also having this undercurrent of insecurity that this clown feels.
Yeah.
And he does all three of them.
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah. It's I'm not a huge Harry Kim fan, but this is really good use of Harry. And I think he plays the distress really well.
Mm-hmm.
But also shows off his strengths.
Sure.
Marvin Rush, who's normally the show's DP, directed it.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
There we go.
And he did a lot of like tight shots, and
like close-ups on the clown's face and whatnot.
Yeah, and just even on people, just the way he staged people, like some of the close-ups were kind of unsettling. Everything about the episode is designed to make you feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
When you're in that world, when you're in that little world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he did a really nice job with that.
He did. There's a lot of unsettling and sort of claustrophobic feeling to the shots, and it's very hostile.
Maybe that's what I don't like about it, is that it just makes me feel uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of anxiety-making, especially sort of towards the middle, you know, where it looks like the clown has basically got everyone, you know?
Yeah.
It's
all hope is lost.
Yeah.
And I like how at the end, that when he realizes he's been defeated and he's going to disappear...
I love the
use of...
That is a cool
shot. They use a very, it's just very simple. Things just get darker and darker and darker.
It made me think that it should have, you know, this is exactly what Twilight Zone would have done, right?
Especially
in black and white, it would have been, actually, I mean, effectively by removing most of the lighting, it became a black and white fade, basically.
And he's painted gray and white.
And he's painted gray and white. So it became basically like a really classic kind of, you know, Twilight Zone ending, and I was like, "Oh, that part I actually had forgotten all about."
This is
perfect. Like, this is great. Yeah.
I good insight. I hadn't thought of that, but I completely agree with you. I also love that when he's been defeated, he simply says, "Drat."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
I think that goes back to that undercurrent of sort of knowing, you know, insecurity and kind of knowing he may be defeated.
Yeah.
And he's just like, okay, that finally happened. You know, okay, like, oh well. Because he knows someday, right? And then Janeway's speech is great about that, too. It's like, you know, someday you're going to get defeated, which is inevitable, right? Because you're supposed to be able to beat fear.
Sure.
So.
Oh, and I love how alternate Harry, like, keeps to try to buoy himself up. He keeps quoting FDR with, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. The only thing we have to fear itself."
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell, he doesn't necessarily believe that because he's afraid of getting his head chopped off.
Yeah.
Here's one thing I kept thinking when watching this episode. So the one guy does die. One of the three aliens that was released trapped does get his head chopped off, and then he dies. His real body dies of a heart attack. And it cuts back to the scene where they're in the cargo bay or whatever, wherever they are, with these pods. And the guy, they're like, "He's dead. He's died of a heart attack." Why couldn't they just, like, beam him to sick bay?
And they should have been able to.
And then they can't, because that's the perfect way to get everybody out of there, is just kill them in that environment and then revive them. And that's the end of the episode.
Oh, true, right.
There you go. So it's instead of a heart attack, it should have been like a stroke or something where it's like irreparable brain damage.
They had a heart attack, but because they were in this system, you know, they could make up some sci-fi thing. Because they're connected to the system, they're brain dead now or something. Mm-hmm. You know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Play a flatlining noise in the background or something. Yeah, but you're right. That is a small continuity issue.
I wish they had thrown in just a one-liner to explain that away. Like we were just saying.
One line would have helped. Yeah. One line would have done it. Yeah.
So, Jared, if you were talking to a friend of yours who's sort of a casual Star Trek fan, maybe he's only seen a few episodes, or maybe he's never seen an episode, would you try to convince them to watch this episode?
Okay, so if this hypothetical friend is a fan of the movie This Is Spinal Tap, or any of the other movies made by Mike McKean and Christopher Guest and those guys, then absolutely, that's what I would lean on. I would say, No, this is David St. Hubbins from Spinal Tap in his second best role ever. That's what I would say.
Nice.
If they're not a Spinal Tap fan, then there are other episodes I'd probably pitch instead.
Sure.
Although now, you know, Matt, you've given me a nice bit with the Twilight Zone angle. If I say, yes, you know, if you want to see a Star Trek episode. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's something to keep in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
We have to make a black and white version of this, and then it would be really great.
That's very easy to do. Yeah.
It's very easy to do, right?
With
modern
editing techniques.
Yeah.
So that's what I do, Kayla. Anyway, great episode. Classic installment of Voyager.
Yep, and in early Voyager, too.
Yeah. Early Voyager, because I think a lot of people think of Voyager as getting good sort of in the middle period. But
which I
really
would agree with.
Yeah. But hey, here's a gem, right? Here's kind of a weird hidden gem.
Yeah.
Right. And I think... I believe that this episode was so well received by the show itself that it motivated Manowski to come back to Trek for a while. And I think he was on Voyager's writing staff for like 2 or 3 years after this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
So
it's sort of the opposite reaction that Ronald D. Moore had when he tried to switch over to Voyager.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. Anyway, so let's pivot from talking about evil clowns to the devil himself. Brian, are you okay if we do that?
Yeah, let's do it.
Now, I was initially against including an animated series episode because I thought they're all kind of weird, but you persuaded me otherwise. So, tell me, what is going on in the Magics of Magus 2, and why is it so unusual?
Okay, well, I'll read the plot summary from Memory Alpha. While investigating the theory of creation, the Enterprise is caught inside an energy-matter tornado. After emerging from the storm, the crew encounter a world where magic works and science doesn't. Now, that kind of is a true summation of the episode, but it doesn't really get at the heart of why this episode is so weird.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, that's a very vague summary.
Yeah, it's very... it's definitely spoiler-free.
Yeah, it is.
it definitely doesn't give it away. Anyway, yes, it is true. The Enterprise is apparently near the... I think they go to the center.
It's the center this time.
Yep. Okay,
it's the center.
Matt, I was thinking of you.
Yeah, I bet you were.
They did their classic calling it the center of the galaxy, but they clearly meant center of the universe, right?
Right.
Because later
because,
on,
you know,
Spock
space
says...
space-time and all that craziness.
Yeah, later on, Spock says, we are at the center of things.
Yes, right. Like so, all things or whatever, yeah.
It's almost like they claim it's like where matter is being created. It's almost as if they found the origin point of the Big Bang.
The Big Bang, yeah.
That's what they're kind of implying.
Kirk says something about, scientists have theorized for generations that the universe was created from a giant explosion. And if that's true, then, like, what's at the center kind of a thing. So,
yes. Right.
Yeah.
So, anyway, the Enterprise is exploring that, and as is often the case, they run into some difficulties, and they get caught. And what Memory Alpha describes it as is kind of accurate based on the visuals. It's a space tornado.
Mm-hmm.
Some kind of weird time, space-time continuum thing. And I guess because you're in the center of the universe like that, at the beginning of all things, all the rules get thrown out and you can kind of go wherever you want to go. And that's what they do. They end up in this other reality where apparently the Enterprise's systems go down and they're deprived of oxygen and can no longer breathe.
Yes,
and everybody's slowly keeling over. And then this dude shows up on the bridge with horns and hooves and calling himself Lucian, and he manages to restore life support on the Enterprise and reveals that he's from the planet below where the Enterprise is right now, which is called Magus 2. And
Lucian shows them various magics and like the wonder of this world that they're in.
Right.
But then inevitably problems happen when they encounter the rest of Lucian's people. Right.
Right.
And before that, Spock realizes that logic does not work in this universe, but magic does. And so Spock moves a chess piece with his mind. And then convinces Bones and Kirk that basically they can do magic. Oh, but I should say that before he moves the chess piece with his mind, he for some reason draws a pentagram on the floor and stands on it.
Yeah, Did you know Spock looks? Did you know that Spock looks satanic? You guys, if you didn't know, like
BT dubs.
But he really doesn't. He does it for no reason. It's true. It's okay.
Yeah, because I thought. Yeah, at the beginning, it seems like you need these ancient symbols because he mutters on about these ancient symbols, and then they proceed to do it whenever they want, like on the bridge, wherever, whenever. It's like all right.
Yeah, so they end up realizing that they can reality doesn't apply here. Magic actually works,
right?
And they start doing all these things. Like I said, Spock moves a chess piece. Sulu conjures up a girl. And then Lucian shows up and chastises them, saying, "You can't keep doing this because they will notice."
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And, you know, them. Okay, so who's they? And it turns out it's the Megans, I guess that's what they're called.
Yeah.
Who are the beings that live on the planet?
Just a bunch of girls named Megan. That's who shows up.
Yeah. bunch of mean girls.
I think that's it's a bunch of mean girls.
That's great.
Is that what they're called?
Yeah, the Megans.
You're right.
The Megas or whatever.
Yeah.
Bunch of people down below. Anyway, it turns out that they are otherworldly beings themselves and
had been to Earth.
Yeah.
They had been to Earth, right, during the time of the Salem witch trials in the late 1600s.
Much like Apollo, you know, exactly. These were like beings of, you know, immense power that had hung out on Earth for a while and then were chased off, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
So they end up deciding to put the Enterprise crew and Lucian on trial. The Enterprise crew allegedly for the crimes of humanity, I guess, mm-hmm. and Lucian because he brought the humans here and he's apparently spent his entire existence.
He's a human sympathizer, basically. His entire existence, he's been sympathizing.
Yeah, also, all the other aliens are specialists of some kind, and Lucian's crime is that he's a generalist.
That's right.
Yeah.
Weird thing to say.
So they put everybody on trial, and you end up seeing Spock and Kirk defending Lucian's actions.
Yeah.
Which, when you stop and think about it, is kind of crazy. There seems to be a suggestion that there's a certain moral justification for Lucian being who he is.
Yeah, the moral of the story is that, hey, maybe Satan's not such a bad guy.
Yeah.
Well, which is still more of a point than Sub Rosa has.
Yeah.
Oh,
anyway, that is true.
Burn.
It is true. So, ultimately, Kirk defends him, stating that he would give his life to save Lucian, and that whole idea, you know, impresses them, and they give Lucian his freedom.
And that was really the test. They were testing him to see if he would do that.
Right.
And then, you know, that's basically it. They have this little weird coda at the end on the bridge when McCoy, you know, he's asking Kirk if he believes that, you know, Lucian is actually Lucifer. Mm-hmm. And Kirk asks if it really matters.
Mm-hmm.
And Spock says that it may be significant as this would be the second time Lucifer was cast out, but thanks to Kirk, it would be the first time he was saved.
Yes.
Yeah, that was unsettling.
Yeah, it was like, what?
Yeah, and the weird thing that I have with this is, who is this episode designed for, right?
I don't really know. If you are
an adherent to one of the Abrahamic religions, I think you might find this a little offensive, and I think if you're a secular individual, you might find it a little offensive too, right? Isn't there enough to offend everybody in this?
Yeah, it just seems weird. Yeah, it's sort of offensive, yeah.
Yeah.
While still, there's no malice to it. It doesn't feel like it's trying to offend anyone.
It's stupidity, yeah.
An earlier draft of this had God in it also.
Yes, that's right.
Holy cow.
But NBC was like,
I think it's really funny, right? I love that the censors were more okay with, you know, Lucifer than they were with God.
Yeah, I guess because there are visual manifestations of Lucifer.
Yeah.
Manifestations of a supreme being are a little harder to come by, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was...
it didn't stop Bill Shatner, darn it.
That's true.
Yeah, how would you compare this to Star Trek V? Because obviously there's some comparisons to be drawn in terms of both the plot and the theme.
Mm.
and you know, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but like, if Star Trek V is a hard sell for some people, would this be a hard sell to try to convince someone to get into the animated series?
Yeah, don't use this as your gateway to the animated series. No.
Yeah. This was originally pitched though in another form for the third season of the original series.
Oh, was it? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it never got anywhere because the show was falling apart. It never would have. This never would have made air. Not in 1968, 1969. There's no way.
But it was
especially
okay.
Live action.
But it was okay for kids a few years later.
Yeah.
I think, as you said, because it's sort of harmless, you know, it's not really trying to say anything. I think they figured it's pretty safe. Like, for, I don't think it is necessarily, but I mean, you know, I think they figured, oh, it's pretty harmless. Like, it's not really saying anything except for just saying, like, don't be bad. And even bad people, like, are sort of worthy of, like, your pity or whatever. Like, I don't know.
Or I guess maybe don't judge a book by its cover. Maybe there's some of that in there too.
Definitely that.
Maybe, but actually kind of the opposite, because it's supposed to be a twist that he's Lucifer, even though it's
of course he's not.
Would you still defend him if he had another name? Lucifer? And everyone's like,
except for he appears looking like the classical, like, yeah.
Like, literally one was shocked.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got the hooves. Yeah,
and horns.
It was, yeah.
And the evil beard.
Yes. Yeah, it is a classic literature look.
Yeah.
So probably the weirdest stuff about this, though, is that they're whisked away to a version of Salem and then put in stockades. And what's funny is what this actually reminds me of a lot of, and it's from about the same time, is there's a whole bunch of Bewitched about her background in Salem, and they end up going to Salem, and like, she's put on trial for something by her own people and blah blah blah. In roughly the same era too.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I used to watch a lot of Bewitched as a kid. I don't remember ever seeing that.
So this is the funkier, like mid 70s Bewitched, when it honestly wasn't nearly as good. You know, Second Darren, they were kind of reaching for stuff.
Oh, Second Darren.
Second Darren. Dick York all the way. Yeah, Dick York all the way, man. So it wasn't very good, but it's just funny because all I can think of is like, hey, where's you know, Samantha and Darren? They should just pop up here in the middle and, you know.
Yeah, why
not?
Know.
It's just goofy.
You know, yeah, and there was that TV show Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and I think the name of her cat was Salem.
It was. Yeah, the black cat.
And of course, the end, they get to go have a hearty, you know, drink of ale and toast to Lucien, which is also a really weird kind of almost infamous image from this, you know, from animated series and this episode specifically.
Friend Kirk!
Yeah.
Yep. He's by the way, everyone, if they show up and they pronounce themselves like friends and say that a lot, I don't know if I would trust that person. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you have to say that a lot, I don't know.
I am amazed that this show got approved.
It's
that
shocking.
NBC didn't like just lose their shit.
It's so weird. The other thing is
very much like Apollo. They could have just said, you know, this is like Pan from Greek mythology, right?
Right.
Right. Yeah. Anything else?
Anything else? It's just so bizarre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely one of the odder entries in the franchise canon, no question.
Yeah, and it gets 6.0 on IMDb, and the animated series average is 7.6. So
that's higher than I would think.
I agree.
Higher than I would expect, too.
Yeah.
But if you grade it on like that kind of early 70s animation curve, maybe that kind of swayed it.
I know every time I try to watch TAS and I talk to people who are fans of it, they're like, yes, but Filmation, and that's how it was. And I'm just like, I know, but it's terrible.
Yeah.
Oh, the animation's awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, but that is true. That's how it was. Almost everything else
was
like that.
But it's still bad.
Yeah, it's still bad. Yeah, there's so many better episodes to show someone of TAS. I mean, they just really...
Oh, yeah, you show them Yesteryear.
Yeah,
Yesteryear number one. just absolutely. Watch it. Beyond the Farthest Star is good. I mean, there's so many.
Yes, Beyond the Farthest Star is very good.
If anyone wants to get into TAS but doesn't really want to have to watch all of TAS, they just want to, like, know what it's about, just watch Yesteryear, and that's it. Then that's the best episode.
Yeah, absolutely. And Yesteryear has effectively, elements of Yesteryear have now become...
been canonized.
Canonized.
Yeah.
Whether you accept TAS as canon or not, it
the
most
events
definitely
that occurred, are canon.
A whole bunch of it has.
Except there's a young lady missing from Sarek's compound in...
and a young man.
Well, also a young man.
Oh, yeah, true. That's right. Yeah.
There's two kids.
Well, Cybok might have been older.
He might have been a lot older because he had gray hair by...
He was already out of the house by
then.
And
you know him being such a troublemaker. Well, Michael's only 4 years older. So
Michael would
still
only
be a preteen.
10 or 11.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, was he like, okay, yeah.
Because he was like eight.
Where was Michael?
She was at school.
Or six, even. Yeah. She was at school learning to suppress her emotions. Yeah. I don't know. It's cool. But anyway.
All right, Brian, any final thoughts on Magix and Magus 2? Thanks for walking us through it.
Yeah, no problem. It's kind of hard to walk through because it's just
so bizarre.
I think it's worth a watch just for how bizarre it is because we're having a hard time explaining it because it's so funky.
It's worth a watch just for Friend Kirk, just for that.
Yeah. It really
absolutely.
Is.
That's become a meme now too. Like that's a thing.
They make him just like this jovial fellow.
Yeah,
he just wants to be buds.
He's just a party
dude. Super ripped, by the way. Yeah, he's super ripped. He's a party bro.
Oh yeah, and by the way, did anyone notice that he definitely has muscles that like are not real muscles?
Oh, like a 24-pack or something?
Yeah, and like weird. Yeah. He has abs, and then he has weird muscles on the side, and then like weird muscles on the side of those, and then pecs, and then muscles on the side of those.
Hey, you don't know what Megan Anatomy is like? Maybe that's how that works.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, Lucifer is jacked. Who knew?
I just have to point out that the last, you know, I noted my cosplay opportunity from Sub Rosa. I think the Thaw and Magix of Megas 2 also have some pretty amazing cosplay opportunities.
Oh yeah, totally.
The clown and obviously Lucien. And Brian, I will be searching for extra large furry legs and hoof shoes for you to wear.
Oh fuck no!
You get that little fake muscle tee, and then you like
Well, just Sharpie draw on some abs onto your belly.
Oh no! Here we go, you guys.
And then
I'll just start walking up to every people randomly, just calling them friend.
Yeah,
friend,
you have to have a
everyone
you have to
dressed
have a flagon of ale.
Every time you see someone cosplaying with a yellow
TOS,
Kurt.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and then Jared. Yeah. And then Jared, of course, can be the fear clown.
Yeah, I would love that.
Oh, God.
I think I can pull that off.
Yeah, that one's doable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
and
you
will
just
say
get
covered
a hoodie and some
and
face
like
makeup
wool.
And you can pull it off.
Well, he's really wearing like a furry onesie.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like it's a crazy
dog. It must have been hot as hell, by the way.
Yeah. But I think if we're segueing into our next episode, that would make Matt... Would you be the microbrain, the crystalline microbrain?
I don't know. I might be too much of an ugly bag of water to do that.
We'll see.
Home Soil. Jared. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump on you. So this is our last episode, Home Soil. IMDb ranking 6.8, so it's almost 2 points higher than Sub Rosa. But it's almost 2 points lower than the series average. So this is kind of you'd wanted to pitch this to us as a weird episode. So why don't you let us know? Well, tell us a little bit about this. Why did you choose this one?
Especially let me give you a synopsis.
Yeah.
Let me give you a synopsis and we'll talk about it. So when the Enterprise D visits an outpost in the process of terraforming a dead planet, they find the science team threatened by a mysterious new form of life. So, this is it's funny, we were talking about this and just beforehand, and I don't know if this is so much weird, because there's a lot of weird in season one, or just kind of interesting and unique. But, because I think one of the more obvious questions is like, well, you could choose conspiracy or Skin of Evil, because how weird is that, right? Mm. I mean, and
or
I did
Justice,
I
think, or Justice or Angel
or Justice.
One.
Justice.
Yeah. Well, it's Angel One is almost like too ridiculous. to talk about. You know what I mean? So I was trying to pick something a little more esoteric, a little more interesting, because, well, let's face it, I mean, Angel One is not even very good, right? I was trying to pick something that's kind of interesting. So, yeah, we have a kind of an odd episode. Maybe it's more odd than weird, which I know kind of sounds like they're synonyms, but I think it's more like unique and different than straight up weird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would argue though, it is weird to have a thing that generates itself and at one point is called like a living computer chip, and then it starts to communicate and calls everyone ugly bags of mostly water. I think that's pretty weird.
Which is the memorable line from this episode.
And it's the catchphrase. Yeah, that's like the line from this episode. If you know this episode, that's probably what you know of it.
I have to say, it's, for me, that's one of the most memorable one-liners. I don't know if I want to say from all of TNG, but maybe. Definitely from early TNG.
From early TNG, for sure.
So, now, there were maybe some other episodes this reminded you of, Matt?
Well, so I guess we should say that what they find, since that, you know, lovely kind of spoiler-free recap doesn't really do it justice, is that they start to realize that, you know, there's this new terraforming planet. They're terraforming, a new group is there trying to terraform it, and they're behind schedule, which is why the Enterprise, you know, shows up to kind of knock on their door and go, hey, what's going on? You're not communicating. You know, you're behind schedule. And they end up figuring out that there's a silicon-based life form. A silicon-based life form there. Now, if that sounds familiar, this whole setup sounds very familiar, I would imagine, to anyone who knows, especially the original series. That's pretty much the exact setup for Devil in the Dark.
Sure.
And that's not a bad thing at all, actually, to have this kind of comparison. I think it's kind of cool. I actually never really thought about how fairly directly comparable they are in some ways. So, of course, the Devil in the Dark, they're behind, this mining colony is behind them, their per diem, you know, quota or whatever. And Kirk's Enterprise shows up to figure out what's going on Linda Han. And, of course, there they find the Horda, which is a silicon-based life form, and it's killed their staff. And, you know, we figure out that what seemingly an impossible life form does exist. Well, so back on home soil, that's almost exactly what happens here. The terraformers start poking around in a layer of like subsurface water that they don't think matters at all. And someone ends up dying, and they have, you know, the new Enterprise, right? The Next Generation Enterprise has to investigate. And so it's got a lot of parallels that, you know, it's funny, I never really thought about until I rewatched it and started talking about it. And I think one of the coolest parallels is not as much story, but visual. And so it's really clear that the director of this episode, or a producer or somebody, was actually aware that there's a definite parallel to Devil in the Dark. And so they set up a shot that's really cool. There's a shot of Data and Geordi looking down through a tunnel that's being laser drilled out by the terraforming team. And the camera is actually in the tunnel looking back at them. And it is really a very close, you know, homage to that classic, you know, classic image of Kirk and Spock peering down into a Horta tunnel with the camera looking, you know, in the tunnel looking back at them. Mm-hmm. And I'll make sure to post that image.
Matt. That looks really cool.
It's really great, and there's also some really good symmetry with it, which is that Spock is the science officer holding a tricorder on the left. Data is effectively being the science officer holding a tricorder on the left. Geordi, who's the command officer, is on the right. Kirk is, of course, a command. Because remember, this is first season. Geordi's still a command officer.
Oh, sure, true. Mm-hmm.
And then Kirk, who's the command officer, is on the right. So somebody really thought about this. I just have to think it's intentional. You know, somebody thought about it.
Yeah,
and that's really fun. Yeah,
it's really a really cool thing that I'd never really thought about before.
Okay, the other thing I thought from continuity that this episode reminded me of, because it starts off and they're terraforming and there's this weird, awkward exposition in the cold open about what it means to terraform, so they're sure the audience knows what it is. Thinking, isn't there some kind of, like, geological prime directive? What the heck gives these people the right to be doing this? because they're definitely disrupting a planet's natural evolution, right? And I was reminded of the line that Carol Marcus says to Chekhov and Captain Tyrell in Wrath of Khan, where she says, "There can't be so much as a microbe or the show's off." Yep. And here we find, there's a microbe to show's off.
And that's right, exactly. And that's what they figure out is, in fact, they basically, I think at one point, she almost parrots a line from Wrath of Khan.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
Oh, yeah, the Starfleet Corps of Engineers or whatever already surveyed this. And it's like, and
they said that there can't even be the possibility that life could develop.
So that's right. I think that's the nod to we learned our lesson. You know, we're trying to learn our lesson from the Genesis, like, project disaster.
Yeah.
And now we're trying to, you know, project ahead. And if there's even a hint of a possibility that an ecosystem could form on its own, we just don't touch it, right?
See, and I like that they continued those through lines from both of that famous episode and that famous movie without directly citing them, right? I love that they just left that for the
fans. They don't need to be like, say, Dr. Marcus mandated. Yeah,
exactly. Right. Yeah. According to the Genesis Treaty of 2317 or whatever.
Right.
And so that's so, like, especially like in a pre-Memory Alpha time, that's so flattering that they give the audience credit that they can fill this stuff in on their own.
Yeah. I think it's great. Mm. It shows a lot of good taste and restraint, honestly. And I will say one of the terraforming things that I think is really cool is, you know, we've terraforming is this thing, of course, it's the sci-fi idea that's been around, well, forever almost. I mean, as long as people have been thinking about sci-fi and exploring something, people thinking about the idea of terraforming. But I think it's interesting that they actually have like a demo, you know, of the stages and what the stages are going to do. And they actually stop and sort of discuss how it's going to work. Yeah, it's kind of a little exposition heavy, and it's kind of more like explaining for the audience. But they actually did a pretty good job with that, because it's fairly natural, because they say that, you know, these guys are the specialists, right? The Starship guys are the generalists, and kind of, but these guys are terraforming specialists. So they actually, you know, they have, you know, Riker and Data and everyone actually want to know this, right? Like, they actually come in sort of ignorant of it and have them explain it to them. So it's actually a fairly natural way to... Mm-hmm. It wasn't terrible exposition, I would say. It actually worked out pretty well.
And I have to say, I really liked that, because it was, you know, as a scientist, if I walk in somewhere, I want to be like, oh, what are you doing? How do you do it? How does it work? Show me everything. Mm-hmm. So I was feeling the same way. And I really liked about this episode how much I believed the circumstances surrounding this crystal creature, and how basically it lives in this hypersaline layer of water in the water table, which is really close to the surface. And it's close enough to the surface that light energy can get into it, because it's photoreactive. So it makes its energy from light. I guess they said infrared light at some point, but it makes energy from the sun. And if they dropped the water table just a couple of centimeters so that the light could no longer penetrate to that exact depth, then that would be killing them. And I was like, that's so great, because they could have very easily said, oh, they just need to live in the water. And so if we remove the water, then they die. Or if we desalinate the water, which is what they were doing, they were removing the water, desalinating it, and pumping it back in.
Yeah, but it was really, that was killing.
I love that these crystalline creatures exist in this really delicate balance, and this planet is perfectly suited for them, and they're perfectly adapted to this environment.
Yeah, they're a perfect like organism for it, basically. Yeah,
so it's very. I totally bought it, 100%.
Yeah, and of course the fact that it doesn't appear to be living by any measurement we know, you can see why. Of course, it was not. You know, thought no one thought a thing about it, right? They thought, oh, it's a perfectly lifeless place, you know, to terraform. Mm-hmm.
So I got to be honest, Matt, I didn't find this episode particularly weird. What I found it, however, was awkward, right?
Because awkward, okay.
And my reaction to this was, because this is great Star Trek stuff right here, where there's conflict without villains, right? There's just this misunderstanding and an idea that we need that if the Enterprise crew hadn't shown up to facilitate this communication, then this creature would have been killed. And I think it's kind of a perfect Star Trek idea. The problem is it happened in season one instead of season six, right? Because if they'd done it later on when they were a little more comfortable, it would have worked better. And if you don't mind, I'm going to list a couple. I don't want to take too long doing this. List a couple of the things that I found was awkward. First of all, like some of the opening exposition I thought was a little awkward, where you talk about they're visionaries who see the planet as what it could be. It's like, Okay, thank you. Could you find a less awkward way to say this? There's well, some lines that were like, there were the scientists, like Kayla, you're saying, scientist is describing what she's doing, and Riker says, you make it sound so poetic. And I'm like, no, she doesn't. She makes it sound scientific. Right? There's nothing poetic about it at all. It's just that's his awkwardness.
That's Riker's trying to hit on her, man. That's what that is.
Okay, and we'll get to that. We'll get to that later. Okay,
yeah.
There's the characters are still very much defined by their powers, so to speak.
Yeah.
Like Geordi has to do some like his supervision stuff, and Data dismantles the thing to show that he's got superhuman reflexes and strength, right?
Yep.
And
yep.
Deanna is more empathic in this, like I mentioned in Sub Rosa, than we ever see her, right?
Yeah.
And to the point where it's kind of awesome to see her being as in charge as she is with her powers.
She's super useful. It's
extremely. But they kind of just realized they had to tone that down, or else it would have ruined a lot of future mysteries, right?
Yeah, because she'd know totally. Everything.
Yeah. But it's nice to have her doing this here. And then Riker's power that defines him is that he's super handsome, because Deanna is so empathic, but she can't read this one lady scientist's mind, so she basically pimps Riker out to go pump her for information, which just feels weird. Okay, and all the guest stars just seem terrible. They're all just like their acting is really bad.
Even the guy
who was in James Bond, the main guy, the Russian.
Walter Gattell.
There we go. Yeah. Thank you, Brent.
I thought
General Gogol.
General Gogol. Yes.
Yeah, I thought the younger guy was the best of the three of them.
And he was really the guy with the mullet.
But
yes,
the guy with the mullet.
The mullet.
Okay. I don't know. Yeah. They were all doing a pretty mediocre job.
Yeah, even he's not particularly great. And then the thing that I thought was really weird is when they're talking about how the creature is photosynthetic, Data is practically like yelling at the captain about it, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, why would anyone react this way? And why particularly is Data reacting this way?
I don't actually remember that. That's weird.
Oh, it's weird. Yeah. It's really weird. Okay. It's
awkward, I wonder why that didn't stand out to me. Huh.
Yeah, Brent, like, looked like he was trying to experiment with different ways to play Data in this episode. And he's like all over the place.
Yeah, and again, by season 6, they would have caught it. So that's my rant. I don't think it's weird, but it is kind of awkward.
Well, anyway. I think maybe you put your finger on it, because as I sort of said, you know, at the beginning of this little segment here, at first I kind of thought this was weird, and then the more we had sort of, you know, talked about it a little bit through earlier in the day, the more I was like, I don't know if it's weird. Maybe it's just, you know, sort of typical season 1, you know, awkward oddities and awkwardness as they sort of find themselves. And so I think you're right. Maybe this actually belongs in an awkward episode list, not a weird episode.
I have to say, I think this is one of my favorite season 1 episodes. I really like this episode.
Yeah.
And you know,
I would rank it highly.
Yeah. I rank it a lot higher than I even did even before doing the rewatch for this. This is one of those ones that is totally skippable in my mind before. And now I'm like, no, it's awkward, but it's good.
So,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't.
So, Matt, if you were trying to convince a casual fan to get more into Star Trek, would you tell them that they should watch this episode?
I think this is maybe like second tier. I don't think I would lead with this, I have to say. It's a little too awkward. It's a little too unpolished.
That's a great word to use. If someone wanted to start from the first season, but they'd heard bad stuff about the first season, and you'd say, okay, watch these 4 or 5 episodes, would you include it on that list?
Yeah, I think actually, as we sort of talked about, I think I'm reconsidering it, and I think I would throw it in on the list, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think I would put it in, like, the top 5 from season 1.
Yeah, I just wouldn't put it as number 1.
Yeah, no question.
I think, you know, because to me, Star Trek is so story driven, and that's I get so much out of the story, so I put a lot of weight on the story over other things, and so I'm a lot more forgiving, I think, than most people to the unpolished nature of it, because it's easier for me to wave those things away and explain why they are the way that they are. But at its heart, Star Trek has to tell good stories, and I think that this is an awesome story, and I think it's well executed. I think there's some messiness and some amateurishness, like you said, unpolished. But I really think this episode is really fantastic. I think it's super, super Trek. And I might actually recommend it to someone that wanted to get into Star Trek. Maybe not the first episode to watch, but...
Yeah, I think some of the abstract kind of nature of the being, whatever it turns into, and calling it ugly bags of mostly water is either going to amuse someone, or kind of piss someone off and find it really like weird and off-putting. Like, why is this crystal like yelling at us? You know what I mean? I'm not really sure how people will fall on it.
There's a really great story. Like, it's almost like that Discovery episode that Kirsten Bear wrote. Mm-hmm. Where, like, there's a great, great Star Trek episode in here, but it just doesn't quite get to the finish line.
Yeah.
Like, you can't push it all the way through to greatness.
Yeah.
And that, again, you know, that's just an artifact of season one. They don't know how to.
Right.
You know, they don't know what greatness is yet. Yeah.
Yep.
I do think the story, though, is quintessential Trek.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. 100%.
Yeah, very, very much.
Yeah. Okay, another continuity bit occurred to me when they say the ugly bags of mostly water. That's like in By Any Other Name, when there's the aliens from the Andromeda Galaxy that are like sucking all the water out of people to shrink them, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Man,
and
this
they leave
episode.
Them with little dodecahedrons.
Exactly. Yeah, the little 12-sided dice.
Yeah, and I also was reminded of a bit in the Omega Glory when they go on the bridge of the Exeter.
Oh, right. They're all salt.
And they find all those people crystallized down to nothing. You just see the uniforms and all those crystals on the ground. And McCoy says, when you take away all the moisture in the human body, all you really have left is like 3 or 4 pounds of chemicals.
Oh, yep. Like,
there you go.
Dude.
You know, so it just reminded me of that. It's just kind of an allusion to that.
This episode has layers. This is the Onion episode of season one.
It has layers. It has layers. Oh my gosh.
It has a layer of sand. It has a layer of salty water.
Exactly. It's got layers, yeah.
But don't talk about strata. Photosynthesis or Brent Spiner will get mad at you. Yeah, if I were to play one of these things as not like the other with the other three episodes here, this would definitely be that. But Matt, I'm very glad you recommended that we watch it for this episode.
Yeah, who knew? So it's not so much weird, it's just season one.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, well, closing thoughts from anyone on weirdness in Star Trek? Any through lines you've seen through all these that you want to take to tie a ribbon on this, the 45th installment of the Shuttle Pod podcast?
Oh, I just will say one thing I didn't mention is I do like that we actually have two episodes that in some way involve terraforming.
Oh, sure.
Which is that in Sub Rosa, that the Caledonia or whatever colony is, of course, terraformed, and that plays a part. Right. That plays a part in it, that their, you know, weather control stations are not working right for whatever reason. So it's kind of, you know. And then here at home soil, we see the start of what a terraformed planet might be.
Is that the name of the planet in Sub Rosa? It's Caledonia?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Okay, yes. So here's my Trek anecdote. Here's my Trek anecdote. A few months ago when I was doing the this pub trivia with some friends of mine, one of the questions was, what was the Roman term for Scotland? And none of us knew it. And if I had been riding the Sub Rosa subway, I would have known the word Caledonia, and I might have gotten that right.
Sorry. It's Caldos, you can tell it's derived from.
That's where they got it from.
Yeah, dang, that's totally where they got it from.
Ah, this is what I get for not watching enough season 7. Anyway, Kayla, what were you saying?
Well, and the obvious other pair, you know, if Sub Rosa and home soil are connected through terraforming, the obvious tie between the thaw and the magics of Megas 2, of course, is in the thaw, Harry has his head in a guillotine, and then in Magics of Megas 2, the crew have their heads in the stockade. So, you know, heads in holes theme.
There we go. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Fear of decapitation.
Decapitation theme.
And corporal punishment, I guess. Capital punishment. Well, there we have it. Okay. Wow. Well, thanks for coming with us. If you want to tweet at us or put it in our comment section, let us know what other weird episodes you might like to have us talk about in the future, or other comments that you might have, ideas you have for future episodes. And so on that note, we will sign off. This is my name is Jared Whitley. This is March 6th, 2018.
Thanks, everyone, for coming along. See you next time.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.